At Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr, we're all about celebrating the journey of life and leadership, no matter what stage you're at. And that's where our partners at Standard Life come in. For decades, Standard Life have been helping people navigate life's most important transitions, from planning your financial future to embracing the opportunities that come with a new chapter in life. Whether you're starting your career or nearing retirement, Standard Life is there. Working with financial advisors, they help you plan for your life journey and do it with confidence. Because getting you ready for your best second life involves financial planning, but it's also about making sure you're ready to live it well. So wherever you are at in your life or career, let Standard Life help you plan for tomorrow while enjoying today. Visit standardlife.ie to find out more about planning for your best second life. Standard Life International DAC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr. A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.
Now, my guest today is radio and television host Ryan Tuberty. Ryan, so great to see you, and you're very welcome to the podcast.
Great to see you, Bobby. I always liked seeing you when I was working here, and you'd come through the door. You bring a certain energy to the room that is irrepressible, welcome, and pretty effervescent. So, yeah, well, glad you haven't changed.
Thank you so much for that. I'm looking forward to our chat. I've been thinking about this. Can I start by saying that I get a sense that you had a very happy childhood, close bond with your parents, your siblings, some of whom I know. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, a nice, happy upbringing in South Dublin.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I got good lotto numbers. I think it's something that kind of dawned on me later in life when I saw people who didn't get good lotto numbers. I thought it was terribly unfair. But I was lucky. And I had a great old childhood. And I think I liked being a kid. I liked getting my 10p bags in Mannings and going down to the beach on a Sunday. I was a latch door kid. I mean, collected conkers and played tip the can and you know, did all the things, played football with jumpers and as goalposts. The classic, childhood in the 80s in Ireland. And I loved it. So, yeah, I was very, very lucky. And I had great siblings and great folks that brought, like, my mother brought something to the table, my father brought something to the table.
Yeah. So I am that high energy household.
Well, yeah, there was a lot of talk, a lot of politics, a lot of books, a lot of talk. Yeah. And
where everybody has a voice.
Well, not that doesn't necessarily mean that all those voices get heard.
Yeah.
But yeah, everyone has a voice, and everyone had an opinion. So you can imagine it was pretty beautiful chaos.
And in adolescence, were you slightly nerdy? Were you awkward? Right. Were you very focused on particular things? Were you different?
That's the most polite way of asking, were you disturbed as a child? I was nerdy, but I wasn't geeky. And there is a difference. I mean, if you're geeky, I didn't have my head in a chessboard, you know what I mean? But I was a member of the Irish Elvis Presley fan club, if that means anything to you. And I was a big Elvis fan. My social group became, particularly heading towards leaving, sir, we all bonded over a love of Elvis Presley.
And we used to go Frank Chisholm games.
Frank Chisholm.
There you go.
Do you know what? Well done. So he was Oma. And he had this great mix of Elvis accent that was Memphis, Tupelo, you know, Tennessee meets Oma. So he'd go, there would be a kid in the audience, he'd go, let her come up, kind of Elvis meets Northern Ireland. And we used to go and see his gigs, and who was playing guitar in the background in his gigs, which came to, you know, be of great benefit for interviews many years later. But Adrian Dunbar was he was in the backing group.
Isn't that amazing?
Frank Chisholm. So yeah, big Elvis fan still to this day, and Beatles, so music's very important to me too.
Tell me about the intro to broadcasting. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of an urban myth at this stage, but you wrote to RTE.
Well, this is
anything goes. Will you let me review books?
Do you want a potted version of that? Or
because
I think this is interesting as well, as we get older, we now become vinyl albums, and you drop the needle on the your greatest hits. So this is an early hit. This is like the please me phase of my career. So, you know, I'm having that moment here before I got into the crazy stuff. I was a fairly precocious 12-year-old, and my dad was bringing us, myself and my younger brother, to the cinema, and we ran out of films to go and see. And he said, and my dad was a very, very low-key guy. He wasn't a show-off. I got that from my mother. We can get to that later. But And he said, you know, well, write a letter to the paper and say, look, where. So I did. And I wrote this little paragraph and it was published on February the 20th, 1986. And I recall it because it changed my life. I then got a letter from a TV kids TV show to say, you're obviously a brat who likes to, you know, write to the papers at 12. So come in and review films for us. And I was invited in. I remember the films. They were, it was the Young Sherlock Holmes and The Adventures of Natty Gann, two films that disappeared without trace. And but I was in doing this review going, what? And I got 25 punts, you know, for my troubles. And I thought, that's
big money then.
That's a big money. Yeah. I was also lovely ceremony of it because myself, the dad used to take us to this sort of greasy spoon in town where we'd have, you know, jumbo sausages and toast. And that was part of the treat thing of it. And I thought, this is great. And I kept doing that for a couple of years. And then I got onto the radio for Pop Around, which is a kids radio show, book reviewing again. And then my voice broke, so I was of no use to Man or Beast because it was going, you know, because you were there, Roald Dahl, they're going to, nah, forget about it. Yeah, come back when you're one thing or the other, but you can't have this hybrid human. So off I went then, yeah.
So when you went to UCD then, yeah, to study, what was it, Greek and Roman civilization?
Yeah.
Was there one eye on a broadcasting career at that stage?
No, not really. I mean, yeah. I mean, first of all, can I just say quickly about, I did the arts degree, the much maligned. One of the greatest things a human can do is, if you get the opportunity to do an arts degree, because it gives you a great basis. Yeah. They call it the humanities. But I have taken, I'm now 51 and a half years old, I've taken everything from that degree with me in life, whether it's history, whether it's Greek and Roman.
Yeah.
I can look at a pillar. Like, nothing is boring to me. Nothing is boring. And no city in the world, whether it's Galway or Rome, is boring. So that's that. But I've now totally forgotten your question because I went down the Greek and Roman rabbit hole.
No, but I was asking, had you one eye on broadcasting?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
You said
no,
you hadn't.
No, I was confused because I was 18, 19 years old. What the hell do you think about your future? Yeah. I don't know. But I knew I was a natural show-off. Now, funnily enough, I didn't get involved in the debating societies because I felt that was too much even for me. And I let Dara O'Brien do that and he became a stand-up comic as a result.
Saw him last week. He's still as funny
as
ever.
You know what I mean? And he is. And he has that skill, and that was honed in the debating halls of Belfield and so on. And why wouldn't it? And Pat Leahy from the Irish Times was in there too. And again, very capable speakers and so on to this day. So that was that. So I wasn't really into that. I was kind of finding my way. I was like into the, I loved going to the bar. I loved the social side. I was part of the History Society and, you know, I was interested in the politics and Students' Union. That kind of thing was always just kind of floating around. But I wasn't sure. I thought maybe law. I said, I'm going to do one job. Whatever I ended up doing, I was going to be like good at bullshitting. And it was either law or broadcasting. Now, you'll know, Bobby, I say with no respect, you know that this business.
All the bullshitters are on broadcasting.
Well, do you know what I mean? You get to an age where you just have to admit it and not to dance around it. So, and law I felt was a bit. So I went to the King's Inns for a week. And I said, okay, this could be the, you know, a barrister, you know, could fit my, I kind of like the old fashioned routine of the law world, legal world. And actually it was too much. I felt it was too affected in some ways. And I don't think so. So I kind of put all my eggs into the broadcasting basket and that's where it kicked off.
And getting into RTE in those days was like, it was something, you know, you had some form in your, you know, in your reviewing the books and
that helped. TV.
So they knew you, I suppose, at some level.
That's right.
Did you start as a runner or a researcher with Jerry Ryan?
That's exactly it. I got in because somebody remembered me from my precocious childhood days, and they said, and I went in saying, "Look, I kind of like to have a knock around here and see." And they said, "Well, go and work with Jerry Ryan show." They took me on. I mean, under their wing, and I clicked with Jerry as a young lad. We just hit it off because I have a much darker sense of humour than people probably realise. And he had as dark a sense of humour as we all knew.
Yeah.
The difference was mine was probably a little less obvious. And he also was obsessed with American politics. So we had a lot to talk about. So yeah, I made his coffee, brought his Danish pastries, and I learned an awful lot from him.
And did you work with Pat Kenny at any stage early days?
What happened was after that, when I was working as a gopher and a runner, I was casting my eye around to see, look for opportunities to be a reporter, to see, just to get a mic in my hand to see, does it work? And could I work it? And a lot of nice producers gave me good opportunities. And among them was then to be a reporter on Pat Kenny's radio show. And again, he was, like, I was very lucky. People are very generous in that way, you know, and great mentors to have. So yeah, I did work. I worked on Pat's show for a while too. And he continues to be, I don't want to say a friend, but we're certainly pally.
We like to do this podcast in an area where people feel happy. We're in a radio studio here.
Yeah.
You seem blissfully happy here just having the chat.
I'm a very comfortable person talking about my mastermind special topic, which is, as my family will say, me. So,
loads more to come on that.
Well, you know, yeah, for sure. So, no, I am very comfortable in a radio studio. I just feel, I just love radio. I've always preferred radio to TV. I loved TV. But I adored radio. And I still do. I'm still on the radio. I'm just saying that I love the intimacy and the warmth of
it's
radio.
It's a very different medium.
It's a very different medium. Because you can wander in here. You don't have to worry about, well, you'd never have to worry about hair, but makeup might be in it. I mean, that was very sassy, wasn't it?
Nice. Why would I do that? Head.
No, but you've got a good cut on the sides with the bit you have. It's neat. You know, you look neat. But equally with me, great face for radio, all that sort of thing. Carry on. So, yeah, I think radio is a beautiful medium.
Staying with RT, your transition through there, the Full Irish on 2FM.
Yeah, that was a golden...
Give us your memory of that, because that was a great show.
It was a golden time. I had great people, where Shane O'Donoghue did the sport, and we had a great team around us who gelled. And it was quite zoological radio, if you like, because it was kind of anything went, and we had great freedom to very much be who we were. I was able to, we were on 2FM, so it was a music station, but they said, you know, you want to play a Sinatra song? That's mad. I said, yeah, but it's bloody good. So they let me play. And so that was, my essence was able to come out, because I said, look, I like Sinatra. I'm actually quite enjoying that Franz Ferdinand track. And, you know, so they let you be who you wanted to be. And that was really beautiful. Because
you were able to build your rapport, your on-air rapport.
Precisely. And the nicest compliment I got on the show was somebody said to me in a Stag in Mayo, you're Full Irish. I said, that's right. He said, I love how it's a little bit intelligent. And I thought that was nice, because that's what it is. I have an absolute credo in media since I was a kid, and I call it erudite tabloid. An erudite tabloid for me is like third way politics for Clinton and Blair or whoever it might have been. And that one, they were they were the leaders of when I was a youngster. An erudite tabloid is essentially you take a story that seems really, really high end, and you give it a tabloid twist so that everyone can understand it. And equally, you take a story like Love Island and you give it a pointy-headed twist to make it more...
And it's a great skill.
It smarter. And that's the way to do it, because I hear programs on radio and they go 2 feet into a topic and you're going, give us an explainer. We're not as bright as you think you are. So you've got to do it. And in fairness, I listen to The Rest Is Politics, for example, and Rory Stewart and Alistair Campbell have this really good thing where they clearly know their stuff. But they'll say, let's talk about Syria. And one of them will say, as a background, and they'll give you 5 minutes, a ladybird guide to, and you go, now I'm ready for it.
Yeah.
So I think that's really
context.
Important. Yeah, don't underestimate, equally give them a bit of context, exactly.
Going back to your old friend, Jerry Ryan, you when sadly Jerry passed, you took over his slot. There was some... I won't call them dark times, but challenging times there.
Yeah.
That he had built up such a rapport. And I suppose anybody who came in after him was going to be, subject to some of the rigors of the public and their views.
You know what? I was only thinking about Jerry Ryan intensely this week. And I'll tell you a story that you can choose to keep or lose. But it was just that day he died. Noel Kelly, my friend and agent, called me. At about 1 o'clock, I was just finishing or getting into lunch, and the phone rang, and he said, listen, I'm sorry to tell you, Jerry's died. And I said straight away, no, he hasn't. He hasn't died. He's acting the maggot, and he'll call you in an hour. This is some stunt. I mean, he's obviously talked to his radio show. They're obviously doing something. Anyway, it turns out, sadly, that I was wrong. Jerry had died, and we had to change the whole Late Late Show that night, because it's fully live, into a living wake with all his old friends, family and colleagues and so forth. But weirdly, one of the guests that night was not stood down, and her name was Stockard Channing, who you'll know as Rizzo from Grease.
No way.
And who was Mrs. Bartlett, Abby Bartlett in West Wing, famous actress. And she came in, and I remember sitting in the makeup department, and I said, look, I'm sorry about this. She said, why is everyone crying? I said, look, if you can imagine loosely Johnny Carson or something, you know, it was just a big moment. And the reason I was thinking of Jerry this week was because I was in the West End interviewing of all people, Stockard Channing, who's in Elektra. And I met her, and she's 80. She just turned 82 the other day. And I said to her, we've met once before, and it was on the night you were on The Late Late Show in Ireland.
Do you remember that?
And I had to keep going because I could see blank. And I said, and everyone was crying. She goes, oh, that night. I said, yes. Remember my colleague, friend had died? And she goes, oh, I'll never forget it. She goes, because I was on the plane over and everyone was going, have you seen? Have you heard? Have you heard? So, you know, it was one of those odd stories. So it's all come full circle now.
Yeah.
But that was a tricky time. But back to your question. Yeah, it wasn't a golden moment for me in my career going in there after that. But I wanted to give it a go and I gave it a shot.
And then Tubridy Tonight was the sort of prelude to your term on the Late Late.
Yeah.
And was that a period where you were, I suppose, proving yourself that
it was probably one of the
I can do this, yeah. This is me, and I'm ready for the big gig.
Well, I always loved watching TV talk show type things as a kid, weirdly. I used to watch Good Morning Britain, and I'd watch Parky and Anna Ford and David Frost and all these guys. And then as I grew up, I was watching reruns of like Dick Cavett. I loved Conan O'Brien. So I was always into it. Robert Kilroy Silk, strangely, was somebody I used to watch when I was off sick from school. I liked the way he went around and talking to people and in the audience. So I was always interested in it. And when I presented The Rose of Tralee for 2 years, which I thoroughly enjoyed, but I asked to be stood down from that because the Tubridy Tonight, the TV show, came on, and I didn't want to dilute.
Yeah,
my
muddy the water.
That's right. So that came on, and it was 5 years of doing that, and I think there was probably my 5 happiest years on TV.
Yeah, yeah, because it was your show,
my show, no
your
legacy,
your personality, nobody asking you to follow somebody else,
not
or
too many committees,
be something else
running it. Yeah, yeah, it was really sweet moment. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Lovely people, felt like renegades. Could invite whoever we wanted on. It was fun.
So 2009, you're appointed to the big gig,
yeah,
The Late Late Show.
I'll never forget that.
Yeah, just talk to us about that time. Because
well, there were a few hats in the ring for that, and one or two of whom I thought were probably very likely to get it. I think I was 32 or 3 at the time. And I was called into the Director General's office. His name was Cathal Gowan, and his deputy, or at least head of TV, was Noel Curran. Two very nice people, and they just sat down with us, with me individually, and for about half an hour just said, so who are you, what are you, and what do you think of Ireland and broadcasting? And I'm talking to you now, I just said, here I am, Lord.
Shoot.
What do you want?
Yeah,
yeah, but I, from the heart. I mean, I didn't have notes.
Absolutely.
Or
let it rip.
And if you don't like it, it's not for me, you know what I mean? So there's no point in pretending otherwise. Anyway, they talked to a few people, and then I got a phone call saying you're required back at the DG's office. So I went up, and it's up the top of a building. And Noel Curran who put his hand out, and he said, you got the gig. And I said, crikey, that's big news. And I went into it. I was then seconded into a little room where I wasn't allowed to talk to anyone by my family, and I called them all, and it was just, they were proud, I was proud, and it was a great moment. And then off it went.
Wow, and 14 years there, Ryan. Mm-hmm. Some wonderful opportunities, like all the people you met.
Yeah.
The people you got to interview, a great privilege.
Yeah, and work with.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a real privilege. I suppose if it was politics, you would become Taoiseach or president, you know, in broadcasting terms. It felt that big, and also a big responsibility. I mean, the only, I suppose, downside of it was that there was always the kind of weight of legacy hanging over it, which meant that it was hard to bring it in a direction you'd love to have brought it in some ways. But at the same time, it was live, it was electric.
Yeah.
You know, you walked out there every Friday, and we'd have, with the odd time, I remember some people from the BBC came over to, I was working on doing some radio gigs, and they came over to sit in on the show for the crack. And they said, so what time do you start recording? And we said, no, you obviously missed the memo. This is a what? So you got Neil Diamond and their prime minister are all sitting down. And I said, yeah. I said, it's like the mind of a madman emptied onto the floor of a studio.
Yeah.
I said, welcome to my world. So yeah, it was intense show, and it was a lot of work, and it was a lot of fun.
And 14 years then, like, that's a long tenure in any job.
It is a long time.
But in that particular job, like a hugely intense job, plus you had to do other things.
Well, I was doing radio 5 days a week,
There's always going to be an end day there, isn't there?
No question. And I knew it had come, strangely. What happened was I got to my dressing room one day, and And I had another year on my contract to go. So, and that would have been 15 years, which to me sounds neat. But I said, this isn't about neatness. This is about your soul.
Yeah.
And I was listening to my soul. And the soul said, have you another season in you? And the answer was, you can pretend there is, or you can answer honestly. And if you pretend there is, you're going to do a pretty mediocre year.
Yeah.
You're going to let yourself down, the audience down, your team down, the organization down, because you're not in it. So I looked in the mirror and I said, I'm out. Yeah. And I rang my daughters and I said, girls, I think I'm going to get out of here. Of the show, not the radio, just the TV. And they said, you look different immediately. Because obviously I had this scrunched up face, or at least attention.
Weight lifted off your shoulders.
Now, you know, the people close to me said, were questioned the wisdom of it. And I said, there's only a few people who'll understand what this show is, what it is to do this show. I'm not trying to make it sound like it's an important thing in life necessarily, but not, it's a very strange place to be. But I'd had the COVID years as well, and they were really intense shows,
yeah,
with no one in the audience. And that took an awful lot out of, yeah, me, to be honest with you, physically, Bobby, and probably mentally too. And I was spent, and it was time to go. So, yeah, then we announced that and we did the last few months of the show. And it was glorious. I had a lovely time saying goodbye.
And just before we leave it,
yeah,
again, for me as a viewer, mm-hmm, you appeared at your happiness during the toy show,
oh, yeah,
and well, the kids, and you really made that your own. And again, that was effortless on your part.
But it did.
It was just something that you did.
I'll say it was effortful for everyone behind the scenes, because they're going, I mean, it was a monster. It was a beautiful monster made of marshmallows and balloons. But I got the easy part in that. You're dead right. That was my happiest.
Yeah.
Just look back to what you were asking earlier about being a kid, you know, and my Tempe bags in the shop. I loved being a kid, and I still like watching Shrek and, you know, Toy Story. So I've a big kid.
Yeah, that's great.
Brain. And I think that I often speak to Chris Evans over now in London about this. Like, he's another big kid. And I think big kids know each other. I think you've got a bit of it in you, to be honest with you.
I think I probably have.
No, I think you have. No, but it's a compliment. You know, it is, because I think if you lose that.
Tell bad dad jokes.
Yeah. Well, that's you should be defenestrated immediately. But I do it too. Guilty as charged. But it's fun being childish.
Yeah.
You know, as long as it's not damaging.
Well, you see the lighter side of things?
Always. I've developed a few credos in the last couple of years. And one of them is to err on the side of joy. I love erring on the side of joy. Rather than, you know, if the fork in the road, I'll always go with the fun bit if I can, because life's too short.
Okay, we're not going to spend long on this next bit.
Let me guess.
It's this is podcast on leadership.
I understand.
And I just want to ask you, you know, did you feel that there was a failure of leadership in your departure from the state broadcaster by others and maybe indeed yourself?
Yeah, I think I'm not really willing to get into that big conversation just yet, because it's I'm still processing, would you believe, all of that. I have long conversations in my head about it still, even though I have largely put that episode in the rearview mirror. But it's a very legitimate question, actually. And I think that communication was the greatest fatality in what happened.
Yeah.
That with better communication and better analysis and better decision making all round, we would have had probably a happier outcome.
Yeah.
So that's what I'll say on that.
Okay, and enough said.
That's okay. No, it's a fair cop. But what I'll say as well is that, just on that, is that, you know, I come home and you know, whether it's on Instagram or it's on the street, people are extraordinary in their warmth.
Yeah.
And their bon mot and their kindness. And it gives me such a lift when I'm on the plane or on the train or in the pub. Is quite funny now. So when I'm in O'Donoghue's having a pint, around Christmas was gas, because all these 20-somethings were coming up going, you're my childhood. You're my Christmas. And it was really cute. They all wanted pictures because they were all young, you know, for 14 years.
And all they grew up with you.
I grew up with you. And that was their Christmas and their toy. So you get this lovely glow, this afterglow. So look, while that whole episode, what I call it, the kerfuffle, was not nice, and I didn't like it. And you know, I don't think anyone came out of it really necessarily particularly well. But it did give me a beautiful cosmic nudge to do things I never thought I'd do in my life. And we'll come to that in a sec, I'm sure. But I'm just saying that I'm a different person, and my DNA has changed, and my mindset has changed, and I think I'm a much more relaxed person, and I'm less self. I care less about not just what people think. Of course, I care about that. I've got an ego the size of Mount Rushmore, but I care less about. There was a time if I was coming in to see you, I'd probably put on a bloody suit.
Yeah.
Look at me now. He said.
I think you said that you've got better at the hard yes.
Yeah.
And the hard no.
That
might have been one of the experiences out of it.
Well, I think so. Funny, you know, this is a leadership podcast, and I felt I was kind of thrust into some sort of quasi leadership position during the COVID years on the late, where I keep getting this that people say to me, you know, my mother was really lost, and she loved the going to the town square on a Friday night, which became your late, minding people to how to do this,
yeah,
how to do that. Good, be careful with that. So that was a sort of a weird role that I didn't necessarily anticipate. When you present a radio show or TV show, you have leadership requirements, because sometimes, and I'm not saying specifically anyone or anything, sometimes there might be a manager or there might be a person who isn't calling it in our eyes correctly. That is to say the team feel is slightly misled.
Yeah.
And your job is to kind of slightly Boutros galley it up a little bit and gently soft powering positions to make people feel that everyone's winning. I mean, you do want everyone to win. Isn't that how you would want to leave every conversation?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with it. But yeah, and you know, it's like you come across a negative force and you just want to say to them, just go eat.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr.
A News Talk original. Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
Do you think now that you went to London and
yep,
are delighted to see your figures are going really strong
going
and it's
well,
all been good, but did you think maybe looking out of all the years at RT that you might have been better off working somewhere else?
No, because I mean, I loved my time in RTE.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not one of those people. I'm definitely not one of those people. I think people expect me to go, God, you must hate them and hate them. Not at all. I worked with the greatest bunch of people. And
I didn't mean that.
Sorry.
I just meant in terms of the experience of another organization or doing different things.
There was a time a number of years ago, about 10 years plus, where I was over on BBC Radio 2. I filled in for Terry Wogan, Graham Norton, Simon Mayo,
yeah,
and all these people, and Chris Evans and so on. And I was getting a taste for it. And the question was, do you want to come over here and have a go, or do you want to or stay in Ireland, or what do you want to do? And my kids were too young, and there was no way I was going to, and I'm not trying to do it, it wasn't great, it was kids. It's just there wasn't a chance that I was going to move from the country at all. And weirdly, fate had a different plan, which said, not yet. You know, this will happen. I didn't know this. And then obviously everything happened, and I got this nudge, and suddenly, and my girls were now young, amazing young women, and, you know, I didn't have to be here as much. I'm here as much as I can, and I'm always there for them, if you know what I'm trying to say. But I could go without having to worry about school anymore and stuff like that. So, the timing was weirdly quite good.
And probably there was maybe a bit of darkness when you arrived because you were just trying to shake off all the other... But now you're into it.
Yeah,
you seem to have resettled.
That's right. It was a very... I think anyone listening to the podcast will know how discombobulating it is to start again.
Yeah.
And I was really starting again. New career, new school vibes in Virgin Radio. But I landed in a place... I feel like it's like Dorothy. I was kind of blown away from Kansas and I landed in Oz.
Yeah.
That was really lovely. And it's really colourful. And the vibe was lovely. And there's respect. And there's kindness. And the people I work with are knockout. And I'm on the 14th, 17th floor of this extraordinary building that faces the Shard. And I look out at this and I see the London Eye and the Big Ben. And I just think, here I am. Like, I'm living pretty much on Abbey Road. I'm a Beatles nut. I pass the Zebra Crossing every day. I get onto the tube in St. John's Wood. I'm seven stops. I barely get to read two. I go down Piccadilly. I pass by Hatchards, five floors of books in Waterstones or whatever it might be. You've got the museum. I've got my O'Donoghue's in London. I've got the Devonshire in Soho, run by an Irish guy.
I wanted to go. About it.
No, you got to go there. And yeah. I call that London-Donoghue's because it covers both. But it's a little, it's not too up, but he's brilliant and he became a friend and I made new friends. I never thought at 50 you could have another go.
Yeah.
Because what I was, the plan had been kind of, I'll stick with radio here on RT and dip. I wouldn't have dipped.
Yeah.
I know I would have just, I would have coasted. So now I'm in a position where I'm doing this. I'm writing a column for the Irish Daily Mail on a Sunday, which is a diary from London, which is lovely. I've got my books podcast, which is The Bookshelf with Ryan Tubridy, which is great because the Virgin show is music based with some interviews, whereas The Bookshelf allows me to.
And you can have chats like this. Long
form interviews with about three books from somebody's life. And it's not, I always say, it's not a podcast for book lovers, it's a podcast for story people who like stories. So I'm really enjoying that. So it's packed. Like London, I pack it. I do this. I do 5K little run every day, whether it's at 6 a.m. or 5 p.m. I go out and I run through Regent's Park or up Primrose Hill. I kick the wall of Daunt Bookshop in Marylebone and back. I see the goslings becoming geese and the ducklings becoming ducks. And, you know, and yeah, it's a very interesting life I didn't expect to have.
Good man. That's great. Well, I can sense that you're really
I'm excited about life.
That's good.
Yeah, it's great.
Because you need to be buzzed, don't you?
I think that if you, I'm sure, you know, you've spoken to people and who have been kind of counted down and out. And I think the great thing about, you talk about leadership, but certainly I've experienced some great leadership in the last year or two since I went to London. And it quality leadership brings quality colleagues and it just brings the best out of people, that sense of positivity. I think that mopey, grim, dark heads, you just don't beget quality. It's been great.
You've always been very proud of your Irishness,
usually
your O'Donoghue's and all that goes with it. Do you miss Ireland, not waking up here every morning?
Yes,
even though
I do.
You like what you're doing and you're buzzed about London. But
I do miss Ireland, Bobby, because I'm
what do you miss, Ryan?
Well, I'll give you a small example. This morning I woke up and I was having my coffee and I just heard a seagull make his little bark in the sky and I thought, I haven't heard that for a while.
Yeah.
And I miss the sea. And I miss the
pier.
The pier I ran down it this morning. It was beautiful. And yesterday and the day before. So I miss that. But I also, I just love the bones of this country. Like if it was a person, I'd say I love the bones of you. And that's how I feel about it. I love the history. I'm doing a lecture in Ashford Castle in a few weeks' time about the Tubridys in Connemara. And it's fascinating.
Lots of them there.
Well, there was civil, there was interesting. Actually, if I could tell you a quick little story. Sean Tubridy was the local medical officer. And when the Free State got, he was on the wrong side of history in terms of jobs. And when the Free State came along, they said, you're out. Like quite Trumpy. Out you go. And the position became vacant and all the locals wrote letters to the government and said, get him back in. He's looked after us for Spanish flu, with cholera, the whole lot. Then none of the local doctors went for the job out of solidarity and they had to reinstate him. Loved that. And then it came across his father was a teacher in Carrarua, in Carrarow, and the local priest took a turn against him. And he tried to get him out and all the locals wrote letters and
there
said,
you
got to keep this man in. I'll just say, as history continues, skip to generation, I have about 1,500 to 2,000 letters from people of Ireland at home in boxes from what happened. And I haven't answered them yet because it's too, I'm probably still a bit raw about that because I'd get upset reading them, but there wasn't one negative. And isn't it funny? The people writing the letters.
And you know,
all these years later,
I spoke to Michael Healy Ray last week and talked about all politics being local, and it is.
It's all local.
And if you don't look after, he says, and you know, like him or not, or don't agree with him, but what he says is true. If you don't look after the people in your neighbourhood, you know, you're not going to be going up to Dublin.
I wrote a piece about the Healy Rays, and which was along the lines of, only a fool would underestimate those boys. And if you, all you need to do is drive down Kilgarvan and out towards Kenmare on those beautiful roads.
We were there last weekend.
You know the score. And then who's laughing now? Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yeah, just watch. I just think snobbery is an awful curse and you have to call it out.
Just staying with Ireland, Ryan.
Yes.
Rural Ireland and your love for Connemara and, you know, your family association with the Abbey Glen Hotel.
Ah, Brian
all that
Hughes.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
So
only talking to him this week.
So, are you... Are you habitual in things like that?
Yeah.
You'll do that every year?
Oh.
At the same, that's just something that will always be part of you.
This is it. My grandfather and my great-grandfather, obviously from that part of the world, having come from Mayo and Clare originally backgrounds, and grandparents, I should say. But actually, weirdly, I didn't realise how profound the connection to the land was. That only since I was a kid, we used to holiday out in Ballinahown, which is near Inverurin, which is about 10 kilometres or 20 kilometres away. And there was all this history, but it wasn't until we did Who Do You Think You Are that I realised how intense it was.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because I get this weird need to be back in the west of Ireland every so often. It's like a calling. That sounds a bit airy-fairy, but it does feel like that. I can't explain it, but there is a connection with the place and the people. They were very good to me. Very good to me when things weren't great. I had a lovely refuge there.
Yeah, yeah.
I played a lot of pool and drank a lot of beer and I had a great time.
That's all good.
Yeah.
What about fishing?
Oh, just talking to the taxi man about fishing. You're hitting all the right points there. So I go out with a guy called Mike Healy out of Uachtarard on the Carib every so often. And he indulges me. He's a man of the lake. You know what I mean? He won't say a lot, but he knows everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll stop on one of the islands, light a fire, and have some food and the tea in the volcano. And we'll cast the fly and catch a salmon, but certainly a trout here and there. So I will catch and release, obviously. But yeah, I find being on a lake fishing, I wish I had more time to do it. And I'm due out to go out. Of all people I met in the Devonshire, Fergal Sharkey, you'll know from the undertones. And we got on really well. He came on the radio show. Not only does he fish, he is now one of the foremost environmental activists in the UK for clean rivers and lakes. So I'm on a promise with him to go fishing between now and the summer. So yeah, fishing is one of my little...
Good job.
It's just very peaceful and it's very... You're at one with nature and you talk about bird song. I mentioned the seagull earlier on. Just the one seagull. But there wasn't a whole family. Obviously a bit lost. But yeah, they're the things that I love. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go back to leadership for a second.
Sure.
In terms of maybe your own leadership style. It's warm. It's open. It seems to me to be like really genuine. Are you a big believer in leading by example, as I am?
Yeah, I would be. I think you can roll over. I think that's really important. But equally, I try not to hold a grudge. I think I see people...
Sometimes that's difficult.
I think it's really hard. But somebody mentioned this expression to me because obviously I was so tempted to hold a grudge or two. And somebody said, well, you know what a grudge is a bit like? Is holding two lumps of hot coals in your hand and walking around town and going, I'm going to throw them at him someday.
Yeah.
As it goes through your hand.
In the meantime,
you're destroying yourself. You're destroying yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think if you want to call it a leadership style, I lack attentiveness sometimes to detail. I think that's definitely something I should have been a bit more on top of.
None of us are perfect.
But I do believe in bringing people together in the most jovial way and in the most convivial way. I love that sense of, is it fixable? And let's talk about it and talk it out and talk it through. It's like if you're fishing and the knot gets tied, untangle it together and start casting again. I just don't like strong arm stuff.
Yeah.
I don't like passive aggressive stuff. That's why I go back to the hard yes and hard no. I didn't have that for a long time in my life, but now I do it. So there's no faffing around.
Yeah.
As long as you can do it politely, I firmly believe, I always tell kids in school, read books and have good manners. You'd be surprised at how many doors that opens.
Yeah.
Because the books obviously give you a certain eloquence that maybe you wouldn't have without them. And also books, just briefly, sidebarring on books. Books aren't the preserve of the rich. Books are the preserve of anyone with curiosity in their brains because of libraries. So books are free. So don't just say, they're very expensive to buy a book. They're not. They're free. They're given to you by the state. We all own them. Those beautiful librarians all over the place. So read books, and manners don't cost anything. It's so important.
And when you talk about your interest in US politics, obviously JFK, if we look at maybe him for a minute as an example of a leader.
Well, I just love to look. With him, it's the glamour of it, I suppose. In leadership with American politicians, I think more and more people look to Lincoln rather than to Kennedy. But Kennedy just brought something. And if you're interested in Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack and, you know, that Marilyn Monroe and all that era, he just fitted in right with it.
Yeah.
And that's why I wrote the book all those years ago about JFK in Ireland, because I just thought he landed on the plane. He just did the Ich bin ein Berliner speech, got on the plane and flew and landed on a wet, grey June evening in June 1963. And standing at the steps was this very old, blind, waxen president, Eamon de Valera. And out of the plane came this movie star.
Camelot.
Who had come from, let's not forget, only 3 or 4 generations before, famine in Ireland.
Yeah.
From New Ross in 1848, 49. I mean, it's a remarkable story. Within all those generations, they became coopers, they became barmen, they became local politicians. Vroomph. I mean, it's amazing. Not without its flaws. Totally understand that's for another day. But it's quite the story for an Irishman to go to Boston and within a few generations become the most powerful family on the planet Earth.
And does American politics, as somebody who's got a keen interest in it, does it scare you today?
I find it a little unnerving.
Yeah.
But I do find a few things. One, I listen to lots and lots and lots of politics podcasts, and I watch a CNN hook it to my veins, you know. But if I'm reading a paper in the UK, I will read The Telegraph and The Guardian. I will read The Spectator and The New Statesman. Because if you just sit there reading The Guardian all day long, that's your echo chamber and you're goosed. Whereas you have to read a bit of everything. And with that in mind, Donald Trump said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do X, Y, Z, 1 to 50. Do you know what he's doing? He's doing everything he said he'd do. Now, the majority of Americans voted for him. So this is the puzzling thing.
Yeah.
What worries me most is where the lines are blurring between legality and otherwise. And if you look at that press conference recently with Elon Musk and his son, X, in the Oval Office, with Trump behind at the desk, and you just thought, what a picture, what an image. Yeah. Modi had been visiting from India. And what did Trump do? He met him. And what did Musk had a private audience with him as well. I mean, it is extraordinary. And we are only a few weeks into this man's presidency.
Yeah, and the speed of change is really, really.
Don't you find it compelling, though?
Yeah, and I was again on my own radio show, Down to Business. We were talking about this very thing that said, you know, if you want to really, really get on top of the media, just blind them with stuff. Keep doing different things, signing orders, changing policy.
You're talking about Steve Bannon's flood the zone.
Yeah,
back it all in,
and they won't, and they just won't be able to keep up with you.
And you'll
be able to get 80% of what you want through, because they're just.
And equally, could you imagine how depressing it would be to be Ukrainian, and you see what they're saying? It's just conceding, 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 and appeasing, appeasing, appeasing. And it's grim. It's a whole new world order. But it's for 4 years, and it's actually less than 4 years, so we'll see where it goes.
Yeah.
Patrick's day
might be slightly different this year.
Do you know what? I'm surprised Patrick's day is going ahead. I'm surprised he didn't put the kibosh on that, because I don't think he really cares that much about the Irish situation. In fact, I think the only interest he has to hear is the big hitters, and he'd be looking, sniffing around for taxes and so
on. Apple and stuff.
I think there's trouble afoot there, but I'm glad it's happening. We've got a brilliant ambassador, Geraldine Byrne-Nason, over in Washington. We have a brilliant ambassador, Martin Fraser, and his wife, Dee, in London. So I think our diplomatic service are probably more important now than they have been for decades.
Yeah.
I think it's really important.
Yeah.
And they're doing these extraordinary things. I'll just say one last thing. It drives me nuts when people give out about the ministers traveling around the world. We should be celebrating them going around the world.
Big time.
What countries in the world have the opportunity?
Well, at least I think there's enough of them going to America this year.
Well, they have to flood the zone, Bobby.
Yeah, flood the zone.
That's what they're doing, and they're right.
With SH1T.
Just get in with loads of it. Buckets of green flavoured. But we have to go in there and just shoot them up, bang, bang, and say we're the best, you know, country in the world, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, we should take advantage.
So lastly, can I just maybe ask you then about...
This flew by.
Yeah, but maybe looking forward now...
Yeah.
From that podium in the UK, enjoying the radio, enjoying the podcast.
Yeah.
What is it, more of the same?
Yeah, I think 2025 is going to be a great year. I mean, we're into March shortly, and already it's flown by. I mean, I think last year it was slow because I was going, where am I?
Yeah.
This year I'm going, get on my Lime bike and head for the hills, run, Forest, run. So I'm buzzing about this year, and I think there's going to be more opportunities. I'm in a very interesting place, not only in my life, but in even physically in that building, in the news building in London. And just they, so you've got the Times newspaper, and Times Radio, Virgin, where I am with Chris Evans and Jane Middleton, all these great broadcasters. And then you've got HarperCollins are there as well. And they love everyone working together on different things, so which I think is great.
So you bounce off each other.
You bounce off each other. So rather than in some organisation, you'll say, you kind of, you remember when you were a kid doing your homework and you'd cover it with your arm? They're not
that was
like
never
that.
Me. No one ever wanted to copy
me. No, I wasn't far behind you there. But no, but it's good. So it's a very, I think if we had done this interview this time last year, first of all, I would have said no politely to doing the interview because I just didn't have the confidence, really. I was too shook. But when you came knocking again, I've always admired you and liked you as a person and a broadcaster. So I was so happy to take you up on the kind invitation.
So very finally, Ryan, can I ask you about who is your hero of leadership?
There are some people I've met down through the years, and we could do a whole program and you could do a whole podcast about the great teachers in the world. I love teachers. Mr. Richmond was taught off the beaten track. He was telling us about Adrian Mole when he probably shouldn't have. He was telling us about music and songs and things that he didn't have to. I love those teachers. There's one that the girls had, a history teacher, Mr. O'Man, and he used to dress up as Portrait Pierce and bring them to the GPO. Yeah. Didn't have to. Probably wasn't in his pay grade. So if it talked about the tomb to the unknown soldier or the flame, I'm just the flame of the unknown teacher. I'd like to I just love teachers. I think that they are essentially, their job involves being almost stand-up, not comedians, but stand-up lecturers in front of an audience that doesn't want to be there hour after hour for pretty, not beautiful salary, and they get knocked a lot. So I'm just going to say teachers. I would also give honourable mention to people like Aubrey McCarthy, recently made a senator. I think he's just terrific. What he's done in Tig Lane, love it. I've worked with him a little bit there, and he's just remarkable. Alice Leahy, I've always had a great time for.
She's great.
Yeah, she looks at me and she's just, well, she won't take any bullshit off me. She'll just look at me and the eyes will narrow and I'll go, oh, sugar, okay. So people like that. But yeah, I'm going to go for the teachers.
Good man. Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Ryan, and thanks for sharing all the good things and indeed some of the more challenging times with us. Life and leadership. And my special guest, Ryan Tubridy, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bobby. Safe sailing.
Good man.
Life and Leadership with Bobby Kerr. A News Talk original.
Brought to you by Standard Life, a life savings company for your journey to and through retirement.